we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core, this post July 4th edition. It's Wednesday, July 5th. Good to be with you today on the program. Walker Wildman here with you. I'm your host for The Core today. You'll have Mr. Green. Well, no, you won't. You typically have Rick Green on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but boy, did I take it from Rick tomorrow. I just snatched it right out of his hands, Bobby. So they've got Walker Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Live. No pre-records, baby.
Oh, Rick just got Rick-rolled. Pun fully intended there. Rick just got Rick-rolled. And so here we are.
He's enjoying his time off.
Yes, yes. And he's going to hear from our listeners. Did you hear Walker picking fun at you on Wednesday? Oh, man, I'm sure he'll get back at me, as he always does. Hey, we've got a couple guests on the program today, so you're going to want to stick around for the hour. We've got our Marriage Family Life Conference coming up the next few days. And so we'll be broadcasting live from there tomorrow and Friday with some very special guests live on with us tomorrow and Friday. So you don't want to miss that. Dr. Jessica Peck will be with us live. Dr. George Barna and others will be with us live from the Marriage Family Life Conference tomorrow and Friday. Hope you had a wonderful 4th of July Independence Day celebration. That's what yesterday was. Want to move into our scripture for the week. We're in Psalm chapter 77 for the week. It's a short week, but we're still going to cover it. Psalm chapter 77. This is another psalm of Asaph. And you read the first half of this psalm, and it's pretty gloomy. It's pretty. The writer here is clearly not in a good place, not in a good situation. And he begins questioning the Lord. We see this at times throughout Scripture. The writer questions God. And the writer here says, "Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time?" Boy, does this sound apocalyptic. "Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion?" So then Asaph, the writer here, begins to come to his senses, if you will, or come to the truth. And in verse 10, he completely shifts. All right, we see this pretty often in the book of Psalm. He says, "I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water and the skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side." The writer goes on here and ends a couple verses later. "Your way was through the sea. Your path was through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." That's verse 20 there. So we see the writer shift from doubt, from anxiety, from a bit of depression to immediately or quickly remembering the deeds of the Lord. And when the writer begins to remember the works of the Lord, an immediate dose of confidence, if you will, comes into the writer and brings him back to himself, back to his senses, and back to reality. And so may we do that in our lives. May we shift from a negative, apocalyptic, doubting mentality to one of remembering the deeds of the Lord. And this is the same book where, you know, a couple chapters ago, there was a passage talking about, you know, if I were to mention the deeds of the Lord, you know, we would be here until eternity. We would be here through eternity if we began mentioning the good deeds of the Lord. They are plentiful, that's for sure. That's Psalm chapter 77. Hey, in October, there's this event we got coming up in October. It seems so far away, but it'll be here before you know it. We've got an event at the Ark Encounter. It's called AFA at the Ark. I'll be there, my brother and my colleagues, Will and Mickey Addison, along with all of our children, will be at the Ark Encounter in October, late October, October 26 and 27. It's a day and a half event there in the Kentucky area, the Williamstown, Kentucky area. So if you want to register for that, go to afa.net/events, afa.net/events. We're filling up. I know we were a couple weeks ago, we were at the halfway mark as far as available tickets left. And so I'm sure that's filled up even more in the last week or two. So you're going to want to go over to afa.net/events and sign up for that event in October in at the Ark Encounter, AFA at the Ark. Hey, I want to introduce a few topics before we hit the next segment, of which we'll have a guest on with us. Came across this today. You know, the left they are utilizers, if you will. That's the right terminology. The left utilizes boycotts, just as the right does, just as conservatives do. And my grandfather actually got his start in the early days doing boycotts. And mainly it was television shows or advertisers on television shows that they were boycotting. And it was very, very effective. I mean, it was getting the attention of these major networks because advertisers were dropping their shows because they didn't want to be associated with profane or, you know, non-family-friendly content. And so advertisers at the time really cared deeply about the impression that their audience got when seeing ads on these television shows. Well, the left is no, you know, they're no stranger to boycotts either. I mean, everywhere you turn, the left saying, I'm not going to shop here and we're not going to buy my pillows. And the list goes on. And they've even gone as far as issuing travel advisories. I mean, you would think we're going to Iran or something here. But California's been doing the same thing. California's been doing this for a couple of years now. And they basically started building, and this went through the legislature. I mean, this isn't just... You know, this isn't just rhetoric. This is actual policy and law in California. They started building a blacklist of basically the most conservative states in the union and saying, hey, if you're a state employee, you can't travel to Mississippi. You can't travel to Florida. And the list kept building. The list kept building, and it's actually becoming a problem. There's nearly half of the union on the blacklist. And so that means if you're any type of state employee trying to do any type of state-associated travel to these states, you just can't do it, or you got to raise the money on your own to travel to these states for business. Listen to this humorous Fox report on this conundrum. Clip one.
There are growing calls in California's legislature to repeal its ban on state-funded travel to states with laws deemed discriminatory against the LGBTQ plus community. Many critics say the measure is hypocritical. Senior national correspondent William Lajeunesse has the story from Santa Monica.
We do not tolerate discrimination of any kind, period.
That was 7 years ago when California banned taxpayer-funded travel to states it considered hostile to gay and transgender rights.
What do we want?
The boycott began after North Carolina denied access to public restrooms based on gender identity. Other states followed, Kansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Then came Oklahoma, which allowed private agencies to deny adoptions to same-sex parents. Today, almost two dozen states are on California's blacklist.
I wouldn't call it a failure, but I think at this point in time, with 23 states on the ban list, it's obviously not achieving the goal that we had hoped.
Democrats hope for a kind of economic blackmail.
Until that law changes, we won't be sending our dollars there.
But instead of forcing states to act more like California, nearly half the country is off limits to scholars and sports teams unless they can get private funds.
We think the law was ridiculous to ban travel to other states.
Republicans cried hypocrisy as Democrats like Governor Newsom use campaign funds as a workaround to visit the very states they ban others from going. The governor has said they're unrelated. Quote, the travel ban applies to expending state funds. The governor's travel is not being paid for by the state. Connecting the two is irresponsible and falsely implies there is something untoward.
Oh, man. I don't know, Bobby, if I can finish the segment. I'm going to start crying.
You know, when the governor says he's not using state funds to
so
travel,
what?
To you're still negating the purpose?
Yes, exactly.
What idiot.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man, this is good. This is when I need a co-host because I'm about to start crying. I'm literally crying on the show now.
I help you out, bro.
So let me get this right. All right. So we're going to combat discrimination by using discrimination. All right. Get this. This is what they're saying. They're saying, You don't want to serve LGBTQ, blah, blah, blah. You don't want men playing in girls' sports. So we're gonna combat what we're calling, this is the left, we're calling discrimination. We're going to combat it with discrimination, and that's the virtuous thing to do. Do you see the irony here? That's what they're saying. We're going to combat what they call, this is what they deem discrimination. They're going to combat it with discrimination, and they're on the virtuous side. They're on the righteous side. All right. So 23 states are on this list, by the way. 23 states, nearly half of the union is on this list of do not travel to or don't use state funds to travel to. And this affects their universities, by the way. This affects their public universities, okay? So this has wide-reaching ramifications within the state, all right? Clearly, it's not hurting the conservative states, all right? Because I looked at the GDP numbers per state the other day. And all the some of the best performing states right now are conservative states from a GDP standpoint, at least, you know, comparatively speaking with previous, you know, years and decades. Red states are on the rise economically and from a conservative policy standpoint. So on one hand, we've got California banning travel to conservative states. But listen to this. Look at this headline. This is on the Daily Caller. A group of Democratic lawmakers in Congress, all right, so we're going from California state legislative, state lawmakers, we're flying over to D.C. for a little bit, okay? A group of Democratic lawmakers wrote to the Biden administration on Thursday, this is last week, to ask that it lift sanctions on Venezuela, a country run by one of the world's most oppressive regimes, NBC News first reported. The Democrats wrote specifically to the Secretary of State Blinken and Treasury Secretary Yellen, praising the Biden administration for getting U.S. prisoners released from Venezuela, asking them to do more. The lawmakers also asked for the State Department to reestablish diplomatic relations with Venezuela. And so let's get this right. All right. If you're a California state employee, you ought not travel to Mississippi, Florida, or Texas. But we ought to normalize relations with Venezuela. So Venezuela is a more worthy place to visit and do diplomacy with than, oh, I don't know, our fellow members of the union. And we're the ones that are all about divisiveness, bigotry, and discrimination. Boy, the hypocrisy is as strong as ever. So, the blue state boycott on the red states is just not working, and the Democrats in California even admitted it.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of The Core. Glad to have you with us today on the program. It's Worship Wednesday. That was Faithful Father by Will Edwards. And, Bobby introduced me to this song this morning. And, Bobby, that's from a Tupelo native, right?
He is indeed. His family actually goes to our church. I've actually had the pleasure of playing with Will in worship a couple of times. And, just a fantastic young man, recently married, and he's well
talented.
On his way. Yeah, he's put out four or five songs now in his catalog, and he's hopefully getting picked up by a label here shortly. So
awesome.
God's blessings to him on that.
Amen. Always good to highlight a local. Hey, I do want to go not too far from here over to Birmingham, Alabama. We've got Philip Draghi on with us. Philip Draghi's Director of the Center for Judicial Renewal. He's also a senior counsel over at AFA Action, a colleague of mine. Hey, Philip, welcome to the Core.
Appreciate it, Walker. Thanks for having me on this day after Declaration Day.
Yes, absolutely. Happy Independence, belated Independence Day. Hey, Philip, speaking of, you know, our founding fathers and independence and our Constitution, all those things kind of go together. We had this Supreme Court case that was ruled on late last week, one of the last few cases to be released of the session, if you will, and it's called 303 Creatives versus, I think, Elenus is the name of the other entity or individual in the lawsuit. But this is based out of Colorado. Give us a little bit of background here.
Sure.
On this case.
Yeah, it's a very good result. Interesting case. It's always good to remember, too, Walker, that the court they don't write legislation. At least we don't want them to write legislation. So the only thing the court can do is decide the facts before them based on the law. They can't go decide other cases. So the result in this case is limited to the facts. But the facts are there was a lady named Lori Smith in Colorado that designed websites. And she said herself that she would design websites for anybody. She wanted to go into the business of designing wedding websites. Apparently, she thought that was a nice addition to her business portfolio to do websites. But she was concerned because Colorado had a rule that would be applied against her and require her, as she understood it, to create websites that that endorsed non-biblical marriages. So what she did, rather than just do that and then get sued and hit for penalties and everything else, is she had a law firm, Alliance Defending Freedom, to represent her in that case, to basically seek an injunction to declare that that provision applied to her would be unconstitutional. It was a very limited case, Walker. But again, the court could only decide could only decide the case before it. So the court decided 6-3 in her favor, that her speech was protected. It was biblical speech, that her speech was protected, and that she did not have, that she could go ahead and start creating wedding websites and did not have to create LGBT wedding websites. So it's a great victory for religious freedom, even though it wasn't necessarily decided under religious freedom, but it was still a great victory.
Yeah, you know, Philip, this describes the left as far as the way they litigate, the way they write laws. It's very, very punitive. And, you know, Christians, for the most part, want to live. I mean, the biblical mandate is to, when at all possible, live peaceably amongst men. There's multiple passages on that. So Christians aren't typically out to punitively damage others, unbelievers, you know, get into litigation all the time, be tied up in the civil courts. But from time to time, you have to do what you got to do to defend your rights, especially under our Constitution. But Philip, this the left, especially in Colorado, I mean, every time we turn the corner, they're using these non-discrimination statutes or some kind of equal, you know, opportunity commission in the state to go after Christian-owned businesses.
Absolutely. And it's not as though a homosexual couple in Colorado can't find plenty of website designers to help them, right, Walker? Mm-hmm. And here's a lady who even said, she said, look, if there's someone out there who is engaging in sexual conduct that I think is unbiblical, if they want me to help create a website for them, for example, that they're selling candles, I'll help them with the website, even though I don't agree or may wonder about what they're doing in their private time. But when it comes to endorsing a speech or conduct that I disagree with, I don't want to do that, especially when they can go get other folks to do that. As you mentioned, the left right now is not content to be able to have their cake. They want us to eat it too. Mm-hmm. They want us to repeat their conduct, and they want us to affirm with our expression, with our words, with everything, that we agree with what they're doing when clearly we don't. And so the Supreme Court stood up for us in this instance and said, nope, we can't go there.
You know, Philip, one thing that yourself and some of us were looking for in this case is we were looking for the religious religious freedom angle of the case, of the ruling, of the lingo that the justices used in the majority opinion. But we didn't get much, if any, of that. What's the speculation? Sure. I mean, why do you think this was a heavy free speech case and not much of a religious freedom case?
Sure. Great question, Walker. And it goes back to the thing that I mentioned earlier, and that is the judges can only decide the case before them, and they really can only decide it on the grounds that are pled to it by the attorneys. They're really somewhat limited by what the attorneys do. This is not to criticize the attorneys in the case, because they were looking to get a victory in this case. But the religious freedom angle is in here. On page 4 of the opinion, both sides in this case, Walker, stipulated to what some of the facts were. And it was stipulated that Lori Smith, the website designer who was a Christian, she said that, and this is quoting from the opinion, she said that she will not produce content that quote, contradicts biblical truth, regardless of who orders it, and she has the belief that marriage is a union between one man and one woman, and that is a sincerely held religious conviction. So even though the case was decided on free speech, we're tying in her belief and her speech, which is based in biblical truth, and the court cited that in its opinion, so we really have that to carry forward as a victory.
Yeah, that's good, and kudos, to the business owner here, the Christian business owner, for not shying away from that, and stating clearly, and along with her attorneys, where she's finding her conviction, where she's finding her belief system there. Philip, on a very similar note, over at AFA Action, which is the governmental affairs affiliate of AFA, we've been working for over a year on a judicial project that is really aimed at ensuring we have constitutional judges on the judiciary, not only at the Supreme Court, but at the lower court levels as well. Bring our listeners briefly up to speed on what we're doing there.
Yeah, this is important, everybody, because eventually we will have another vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. Hopefully we'll have a constitutionalist in the White House who can fill those vacancies. But I'm not making any predictions, and I certainly hope that Justice Clarence Thomas, who is my favorite justice, Samuel Alito, probably my second favorite justice, that they'll be on the court for a long, long time. But imagine a scenario where perhaps one of them decided to leave the court in the next term. Let's say there's a constitutionalist in the White House and one of them decides, okay, now's my time, I'd like to leave the court. It would be difficult to find somebody equal to them to replace them. Now, we're going to do that, and that's what we're working hard to do. Walker and I and many other organizations are working very hard on that. But this is important because losing a seat would be disastrous at this point. Many people remember when Ruth Bader Ginsburg left the court. She was so far to the left that getting someone better than her from a constitutionalist perspective was really not that difficult. And I think Amy Coney Barrett was a massive, massive improvement. Mm. But here you have almost an opposite scenario, Walker, because if Justice Thomas were to leave the court, finding someone equal to him is going to be difficult. Getting them selected and confirmed is going to be difficult. And so we're researching over 20 now prospects for the Supreme Court. Walker, as you know, we found five that we think would be great additions to the Supreme Court. And we're letting presidential candidates know and letting others out there know, Senate offices as well, that these are folks that we think would be great future Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, that's very good, Philip. And before we end, and by the way, if you want to read the research, go over to afaaction.net, afaaction.net, and click on Center for Judicial Renewal. You can check out all of our research there. But Philip, when we talk about research and you talk about 20 judges or potential judges there that we've researched, I mean, this is pretty in-depth stuff. This is not one pagers here.
It is. Yeah, we start out, as you know, Walker, researching perhaps hundreds of cases and speeches for each prospect. We call that down to notes in the range of 30, 40, even 60 pages of comprehensive research. And then from that, we develop a summary that's anywhere from 6, 8, 10, 11 pages. And then from that further, Walker, we come up with a one pager that we use for lobbying purposes to share with members of the Senate and others. But it's a lot of hard work, but it's worth it. And when we have another vacancy on the court, we'll have some great names to choose from. And in addition, Walker, as you know, we're also looking at courts below the Supreme Court to find good prospects to put on those courts. Because last time, you know, Amy Coney Barrett was a law professor when President Trump came into office. She didn't go straight from that law school to the Supreme Court. She was placed on the Seventh Circuit. And then almost immediately, President Trump put her on the short list. So whoever's in the White House next, we want to have great prospects for the Supreme Court and those lower courts as well.
Absolutely. Hey, Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
And, absolutely, Walker.
Be seeing you in Tupelo soon.
That sounds great. Thanks a ton.
All right. That's Philip Draghi. He's working on our judicial project, judicial renewal project over at AFA Action. That's our 501c4 government affairs affiliate of the American Family Association. AFAaction.net is that URL if you want to check out our work. AFAaction.net. Right there on the homepage is our three divisions, and the one that I was just talking to Philip about is our Center for Judicial Renewal. And you can see none of this stuff's private or confidential. You can see the 20 judges or potential judges that we've researched. You can see all this on our website, and we've actually got links to the research itself. We've got links to the research there as well. You can see how we've evaluated, how we've graded these judges or potential judges. And we go anywhere from what we call a green list to a gray list and then a red list. And, of course, the green listers are the ones that we think would be excellent constitutionalist judges on the Supreme Court or another court. And gray listers are ones that are kind of undecided. They maybe have some good things about them, but not enough there to really give them a green. And the red listers are the ones we think would not be good for the Supreme Court, and we have our reasons there in the research. So AFAaction.net's where you can check out that research. And folks, that's just one of the multitude of divisions that are fall under the umbrella and the banner of American Family Association. And you know, one thing I often talk about is forward thinking and viewing this culture war, if you will, or this war to maintain and restore American freedom, liberty, constitutional principles. I mean, all of this that falls under the American experiment that American Family Association is fighting for. We are being forward thinking. We are operating with a forward thinking mindset. And that's what this project is all about. We're thinking about, well, number one, who's going to be the next president? But number two, who's going to be recommending judges, judicial appointments to the next president? This is very important because we saw with President Trump, he did an excellent job, a fabulous job appointing judges. Yeah, there were a couple in there that had some issues, some concerns, and we've seen those play out. But the vast majority of the judicial nominations that President Trump picked were excellent judges, and we're bearing the fruit of that now. And we just talked about the 303 case out of the Supreme Court. I mean, this is a Trump Supreme Court. And it was a very, very good case, very, very good ruling. So we're seeing the positive fruit of that. Well, in order to maintain that or even improve upon it, the next administration has to continue appointing constitutionalist judges all around the federal judiciary. Check out that project, AFAaction.net. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to At the Core. Glad to have you with us today. Final segment of the program. Boy, has it gone by fast. You know, the saying is, time flies when you're having fun. I have no idea who coined that phrase, but it sure is used often. We've got another guest with us. By the way, if you missed the interview with Philip Draghi last segment, you can subscribe to the podcast and listen at your leisure. And go back and listen to that great segment with Philip Draghi on the recent Supreme Court case out of Washington, D.C. Good victory there out of the Supreme Court. Hey, we have on with us now Brett Farley. He's executive director over at the Oklahoma Catholic Conference, of course, in the state of Oklahoma. Brett's with us now. Hey, Brett, welcome to the Core.
Thanks for having me. This is a real honor.
Well, Brett, you're on the ground, your boots on the ground, if you will, in the state of Oklahoma. You guys have obviously a heavy focus there in Oklahoma with the various laws and policies that that percolate around the state of Oklahoma, the state capital there. But before we jump in kind of into the weeds and some of these issues that you guys have been battling in recent months and years, tell us a little bit about y'all's work.
Yeah, so Catholic Conference of Oklahoma really is the policy arm of the Catholic Church in Oklahoma. And 45 states around the country have some form of a Catholic conference. You know, the church obviously across the board speaks into the public policy realm as we should and sort of represent the faithful community at various state capitals. And that's what we do. So we were formed in 2017 with that express purpose in mind to go to the state capital here in Oklahoma City and make sure that the faith community was represented properly with the legislature as they grapple with some of these difficult issues, obviously the sanctity of life being chief among them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, on that issue, we've seen the opponents of life, those who want to promote abortion, we've seen them use very crafty maneuvers, if you will, to achieve their ends, to achieve their goals, and undermine the pro-life movement. One of those is through these ballot measures, which oftentimes get very convoluted and complicated from a voter standpoint. Tell us what's going on in Oklahoma. What's been going on with these ballot measures and the pro-life movement?
Yeah, it's a big battle, and it's an increasing battle. We knew on the other side of the Dobbs decision that the fight was not going to end. It simply would change form and move from the national stage to the state stage. And so we're grappling with this, as you said, as boots on the ground at the state level. You know, what we saw in the 2022 election was the pro-abort machine, if you will, spent over $350 million in that cycle across a number of states, largely either in support of pro-abortion candidates or on these ballot initiatives with the idea of getting abortion enshrined in the various state constitutions. Our neighbors to the north, for example, in Kansas, were fighting this fight and unfortunately lost it when they were moving to try to protect life in the state constitution. So they're going to continue this campaign in every single state. There's no state in the union that's immune to this effort. Even red states like Oklahoma, we like to think of ourselves as the red state in the union, you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt, but we're having to contend with this fight as well.
Well, tell us this, by the way, we're talking to Brett Farley, executive director over at the Oklahoma Catholic Conference. Brett, what makes these ballot measures oftentimes confusing and convoluted?
Well, there are a number of things that make them difficult. One is just the wording of the question itself. So, you know, every state's a little different, but there's generally a process, whether it's a petition drive or something that ends up on the ballot via legislation. These things will end up on the ballot, and the language sometimes is convoluted, and voters have a hard time discerning what exactly they're asking. And that was certainly the case in Kansas. And so, you know, unless you're really informed and you pay a lot of attention, which unfortunately is less the case these days with voters, it's very difficult to figure out what these things are asking. The bigger problem is that the pro-abortion machine they're awash with all kinds of cash. They're not going to run out of funds. Part of that is because they get $500 million every year from Congress of our taxpayer dollars. And they're using our taxpayer dollars to turn around and fund these initiatives. And so, you know, again, with our friends in Kansas, they were outspent 10 or 20 times on that campaign. And so they've got money that can back up all the misinformation that they're putting out there. So they'll threaten things like, you know, if you don't vote for this, then we're going to go back to the days of back alley, you know, coat hanger abortions, which never was the case and never would be the case. But scare tactics work. And so you've got tens of millions of dollars being put behind these campaigns to scare voters into voting for pro-abortion initiatives. And it's a dangerous campaign.
Yeah, I almost guarantee you, Brett, if you sat down with a lot of these voters, even ones who maybe vote for some of this nonsense, if you sit down with them and actually explain things fairly, honestly, with integrity, and kind of make things simple how they should be, I would almost guarantee that, you know, the vast majority of voters would vote pro-life. But when you throw this thing on the ballot and then you've got to dwindle it down to, like, I don't know, maybe a sentence or two, and the language is confusing, and then you come on top of that with you know, millions of dollars in ads that make things even more confusing, it's a recipe for disaster. What's the next step forward in Oklahoma? I mean, do you guys have something imminent here, or is this just something to keep our eye out for?
Yeah, we've got a number of things brewing to counteract that effort, you know, and that's, we're going to throw the whole kitchen sink at them if they try to file something. And they actually did try something earlier this year, and we got them to back off that effort. But that includes legal challenges, legislation that makes it much more difficult to get something on the ballot to raise the bar, if you will. And there are a whole panoply of things that we are planning to block those things. But at the end of the day, if something does get on the ballot, you know, our backs are against the wall, and it's very difficult to defeat for the reasons you mentioned. You know, it's, you got 30 seconds to explain a complex issue, a very emotional issue to voters that care a lot one way or the other about that issue. And so it's, you know, it's a very difficult thing to fight. And the abortion industry knows that.
Yeah. You know, let me ask you this more broadly on the whole ballot measure topic. And I know you work closely with my colleague, Jameson Taylor, at the state level. Well, is the pretty much the consensus now amongst our movement that these ballot measures are doing more harm than good? I mean, there's nothing, I don't think these ballot measures are like some kind of sacred right that we've got to have them. I mean, we have a state legislature and our governor, and they can pass laws and measures, et cetera. Right. They can add amendments to the Constitution, to the state Constitution. Are the ballot measures something we ought to be married to, or is this something we could possibly do without?
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of ballot measures in general. I mean, the whole idea of referenda came about as a product of the populist movement in the early part of the 20th century, when there was this big move to sort of transfer power back to the people. That has largely been proven to be a disaster for a representative republic like ours. You know, we elect a legislature for a reason, because they're supposed to represent our views. Giving power to the people to override the legislature sort of begs the question, why do we have a legislature? Hmm. That's what elections are for. If they're not representing the people properly, you have elections, you vote them out. So this idea that we can override them, on issues like this that are so emotionally charged, and that can be easily swayed by millions of dollars, sort of undercuts the whole idea of representative democracy. Hmm. And so I'm not a fan. I think democracy, small d, is a good idea in principle, mm-hmm. but you've got to have sort of controls and checks and balances as the founders intended. And unfortunately, those things are not in play like they used to be.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, you could make the case that Washington is completely out of touch with the American populace, right. And you can cite all the numbers there. And there's a lot to do. There's a lot involved in that whole topic. But when you get at the state level, I mean, for the most part, the vast majority of states are pretty, their legislatures are very much aligned with their population. You look at how issues poll, whether people are more ideologically conservative or liberal across the board. I mean, states are the state legislative makeup, let me say, and the governor's mansion, for the most part, is a pretty accurate representation of where the people are. I mean, this whole state legislatures not being able to get anything done for the people, that just doesn't seem to be the case at all.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the state legislatures by design are very close to the people, and therefore are very responsive to the will of the people. And we see this all the time. Incumbents get voted out of office because they weren't responding to what the people wanted. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the referenda undercut this idea that the legislature is supposed to respond to the will of the people. They do. We don't want a system, whether it's at the state level or at Congress, that is going to sort of switch on a dime without taking the time to kind of grind through these issues. That the legislative machinery, what we call gridlock, is not a bug. It's a feature of the system, because you don't want laws in any situation, whether they're state or federal, to be sort of switching with the pendulum of popular will, because that creates all kinds of havoc. You want to take time to work through these issues, because that's how you work out the unintended consequences. Moving quickly through issues and reacting to situations is what causes unintended consequences, and ultimately is not good for the people.
Absolutely. Hey, Brett Farley, thanks so much for coming on the program.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right. Brett Farley, he's executive director over at Oklahoma Catholic Conference. And if you want to check out their work, check out their website, okcatholic.org for Oklahoma. okcatholic.org is their website. You can check out their work at the state level there in Oklahoma. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, you know, these various state groups, like the one Brett there runs, are very important for our pro-life movement, for the Christian movement around the state. I mean, these are the groups that are on the ground at the state level, talking to state lawmakers, governors, so on and so forth. So we've got to have these state groups. They do excellent, critical work at the state level all around the country, and those are the groups we try to partner with and highlight. Hence, we had on Brett and his group to talk about what's going on in Oklahoma. The left, I mean, to show how much this is a spiritual battle, when Brett cited the financials there, the amount of money that the abortion crowd pours into this topic. I mean, folks, this isn't about like what the tax rate should be, or, you know, whether we ought to have a constitution or not. This is about whether they should be able to kill babies. And to think that people care so much about having the ability to kill babies is just mind-boggling. To think that people get so emotionally and financially attached to this topic that we've got to pour hundreds of millions of dollars into it to make sure that moms ought to be able to kill their babies. I mean, this is just wicked, absolutely wicked. And you sit down, and I've said this before, if you were to sit down and read parts of scripture in different times throughout history, or not just scripture, but also modern history, and you read times where people do wicked things. I mean, many people in American society would just be out of breath at the level of wickedness that has taken place at times throughout human history. But you look at what we're doing in 2023, and how much better off are we? I mean, how much better are we as a people than some of these, you know, age-old stories of tragedy and horrific stuff that's gone on throughout human history? I would say not much better, if not worse. I mean, what we're doing to our babies now is gruesome and horrific, to put it mildly. But the money and the ideological attachment to the topic is very, very disturbing from a moral standpoint. But that's where we are. That's where we are in America. This is a spiritual battle, and the ideological forces are very much divided on this topic. You know, I saw today a report that was showing that people are moving where to places where they feel like their values are being upheld. And you know, this article called it, you know, the most divided from a state by state standpoint our nation has been in a very long time. I'm not going to say ever, but in decades at a minimum. But people are flocking to places that they think uphold their values. I mean, that's why you see the big boom in the conservative states. They're tired of high taxation. They're tired of big government. They're tired of the wickedness, you know, the abortion on demand, the denigration of the family unit, the biblical family unit, the heavy in-your-face promotion of sexual deviancy. People just can't stomach it anymore. And they're over it. They're done with it. And they're tired of their tax dollars and their consumer dollars going to support the garbage. And this is really a result of the cultural Marxist overplaying their hands. They've overplayed their hands. Every time they get a victory, every time they edge up on a victory, they say, this is all we want. Remember with Obergefell? All we want is same-sex, quote-unquote, fake marriage. And then 3 months later, they're in North Carolina wanting boys to go into girls' bathrooms. Now they're wanting to teach our kids about pedophilia and sexualizing them at 4 years old. So, no, we're not giving you another inch because you take a mile. That is the story of the cultural Marxist.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.